Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a really complex and, well, long-debated topic, capital punishment in the United States. I've got some fascinating material to explore with you, primarily looking at a session on Christian ethics by Dr. James S. Spiegel. This covers, you know, everything from the major legal cases that have shaped the death penalty to some really deep philosophical and theological arguments surrounding it.
That's right. Our goal today really is to guide you through this pretty intricate issue. We want to make sure you come away with a solid understanding of the key legal history, the fundamental ethical ideas at play, and the main points, both for and against the death penalty.
Yeah.
And we're going to try and do it without getting bogged down in overly academic language. Think of this as your maybe fast track to getting truly informed on this important subject.
Definitely. And to really set the stage for just how dynamic this issue is for you, consider this.
Yeah.
The U.S. Supreme Court actually banned the death penalty across the country in 1972.
Yeah, completely banned it.
Only to bring it back just 4 years later in 1976. And get this, the initial ban in Furman v. Georgia was a 5-4 decision. But here's where it gets really interesting for you. Those five justices in a majority,
yeah,
they all had slightly different reasons for their ruling.
Right.
It wasn't like a unified, the death penalty is inherently wrong kind of decision.
No, not at all. And what's fascinating for you to understand about that Furman v. Georgia ruling is that the court essentially said the death penalty, as it was being used at that time, was cruel and unusual punishment, which goes against the Eighth Amendment.
Right.
You have to remember the methods back then. Electrocution, gas chamber, hanging, even firing squad, quite different from what's mainly used now, which is, you know, legal injection.
Big difference.
And as you mentioned, the fact that the majority had five different opinions really highlights how unsettled the legal thinking was on this. So the key takeaway here for you is that in 1972, the court wasn't saying the death penalty was inherently wrong, but that the way it was being done was so flawed, it violated the Constitution. That distinction is crucial, really, for understanding everything that follows.
Exactly. It wasn't a clear-cut condemnation of capital punishment itself, but more about how it was being applied, right?
Right.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit more for you. What exactly did the court find so problematic about the administration of the death penalty back then?
Well, the heart of the problem, really, it revolved around it being arbitrary and discriminatory.
Ah.
There weren't consistent rules for deciding who got the death penalty and who didn't. It often seemed to depend on things like race, how much money someone had, rather than just how serious the crime was. Each of those five justices in the majority had their own specific reason why this was cruel and unusual. But the big picture for you is that there was a real lack of fair legal process in how it was being decided.
Okay, arbitrary and discriminatory. And that leads us to the 1976 reversal, Gregg v. Georgia. So what changed in those 4 years that made the court say, actually, the death penalty can be constitutional?
Well, the main thing was that several states, including Georgia, had changed their death penalty laws to try and fix the problems the court pointed out in Furman.
Okay, they responded.
They did. These new laws aimed to make the process more standardized, less arbitrary. The court in Gregg recognized these efforts, saying that the death penalty isn't automatically unconstitutional. They mentioned things like evolving standards of decency, the possibility that it might deter crime, though they weren't totally convinced on that, and most importantly, that it could be applied fairly if the right safeguards were in place.
Safeguards like?
Like bifurcated trials. Essentially, what that means for you is there are two separate parts. First, determining guilt, and then, if guilty of a capital offense, a separate hearing just to decide the sentence. Ah, okay. So the court was basically saying, if you can show us a fair and consistent way to apply the death penalty, it meets the requirements of the Constitution.
Precisely. They set out guidelines, you know, things like having those two separate phases in a trial, one for guilt, one for sentencing and automatic appeals, all to try and make the process more just for everyone involved.
Hmm. However, the story doesn't end there, does it?
Nope, not at all.
Fast forward to 1987, in the case of McCluskey v. Kemp, this one really throws a curveball into the idea of a perfectly non-arbitrary application for you. The court here ruled that the death penalty was not unconstitutional, even when there was statistical evidence showing a clear racial bias in how it was applied. Can you walk us through those numbers for our listener? They're pretty striking.
They really are. What's quite stark for you to understand is the difference based on the race of the victim.
Right. The statistics show that people who killed white people were much more likely to be executed than people who killed black people. Looking at the executions from 1976 to 2019, 56% of those executed were white, 34% were black, and 9% Hispanic. But when you look at who the victims were, 76% were white, only 15% were black, and 7% Hispanic.
Wow. Those are pretty significant differences for you to consider. And to add another layer to this, our source notes only 16 of those executed during that period were women.
Yeah, very few.
It really highlights for you how complex and, well, potentially uneven the application of this ultimate punishment can be.
Mm-hmm.
So even with that stark statistical evidence of racial bias that you highlighted, the court still upheld the death penalty's constitutionality in that case. What were the practical consequences of that ruling for how the death penalty is applied moving forward for you?
Well, what's important for you to know is that while the court acknowledged the statistics, they ruled that this broad statistical pattern didn't prove that there was intentional discrimination in McCluskey's specific case.
In his specific case.
Right. Therefore, they didn't overturn the death penalty as a whole based on this evidence of systemic bias. This decision remains a really significant point of disagreement for people who argue that the death penalty is unfair and unjust.
Okay, so we've got a brief but crucial legal history under our belts for you. Now, to really understand the core of this debate, we need to step back and ask a fundamental question. What exactly is punishment, and what are we trying to achieve with it?
Yeah.
Our source gives us a definition from philosophers Olin and Berry. Pain or harm inflicted by a rightful authority on a person who has been judged guilty of violating a law or rule. It sounds pretty broad, doesn't it, for you?
It is, and that's kind of on purpose for your understanding. This definition is meant to apply to all sorts of wrongdoing, you know, from a minor traffic ticket to the most serious felonies, even to, like, a child breaking a rule at home.
Okay.
The key parts for you to remember are a negative consequence, pain or harm, given by someone who has the authority to do so because someone broke a rule.
Right. So if that's the what of punishment for you, what about the why? Our source outlines three general ideas about the purpose of punishment. Let's dive into those for you. First up is deterrentism. What's the core idea there for our listener?
Deterrentism suggests that punishment works to stop future wrongdoing for you. It can do this in two ways. Specific deterrence, where the punishment makes the person who committed the crime not want to do it again.
Okay, scare them straight, so to speak.
Kind of, yeah. And general deterrence, where the punishment serves as an example to others, making them not want to commit similar crimes.
Makes sense for you. Don't do this or this will happen to you. What about the second idea, reformativism or rehabilitationism, for our listener?
This idea focuses on changing the person who committed the crime into someone who will follow the law for you. The goal here is to fix the reasons why they committed the crime in the first place, maybe through things like education, therapy, job training.
Right. Helping them rejoin society.
Exactly. It's about helping them become productive members of society again.
Which, of course, brings up an obvious point for you in the context of our deep dive. How does rehabilitation fit in with capital punishment?
Well, that's the critical point. For you, it doesn't.
Right.
Capital punishment, by its very nature, makes rehabilitation impossible. Once someone is executed, there's no chance for them to change or rejoin society. So if your main reason for punishment is rehabilitation, then capital punishment goes directly against that goal.
Okay, that's clear for you. And the third idea is retributivism. What's the driving force behind that for our listener?
Retributivism argues that punishment is fundamentally about justice for you. It's the idea that people who commit crimes deserve to be punished, and that society has a moral duty to make sure that punishment happens.
Oh, deservedness.
Yes. It's about bringing things back into balance, recognizing the harm done to the victim and to society as a whole. Importantly for you, retributivists often say that the punishment should fit the crime. The core insight of retributivism in this context is really the idea of a moral debt.
A moral debt?
Yeah. The argument is that society owes it to the victim, and maybe to itself, to see a just punishment carried out, regardless of whether it prevents future crime.
So it's not necessarily about stopping future crime, so that might happen, but more about making sure justice is served for what happened in the past for you.
Exactly. And, you know, as our source points out, these ideas don't have to be completely separate for you. Someone might strongly believe in retribution, but still think about whether a punishment will deter others, for example. Often, people's views on punishment are a mix of these different ideas.
Right. They can overlap. Now, let's bring in some broader moral and ethical ideas about capital punishment itself for you. Our source touches on utilitarianism. How might that way of thinking approach this issue for our listener? It's kind of like, weighing the good versus the bad. Right?
Exactly. A utilitarian approach will look at the overall good and bad effects on society for you. So people who support capital punishment from this angle might argue that it stops future crimes, you know, deterrence, which is good for society as a whole. However, they would also need to consider the potential bad effects, like the chance of executing innocent people or maybe the social costs of having the death penalty.
And rehabilitation isn't a factor here.
Right. Since rehabilitation isn't an option with capital punishment, whether it actually deters crime becomes a really important factor for utilitarians who might support it. On the other hand, if there's not strong proof that it deters crime, or if the bad effects seem worse than the good, a utilitarian would likely be against it.
Okay. What about Kantian ethics for you? That often involves some pretty abstract ideas about duty and personal choice. How does that perspective potentially justify capital punishment? It seems counterintuitive, maybe.
It does, a bit. Mm-hmm. When we look at capital punishment through a Kantian lens, some philosophers, like Kant himself and later Hegel, have argued in favor of it based on this idea of personal autonomy, the ability of individuals to make their own rational choices for you. The thinking here is that by committing murder, by choosing to take someone else's life, the person who committed the murder is, in a way, choosing to give up their own right to life. They are, like, rationally willing that this should happen to them as a consequence of their action.
So they're kind of setting the rule for themselves by their own actions.
That's the idea. It's a somewhat unexpected argument suggesting that the death penalty actually respects the murderer's own, though perhaps unstated, choice.
That's a really interesting and, as you say, somewhat surprising take for you. Finally, our source mentions natural law and moral theology, especially within the Judeo-Christian tradition. What's the situation there for our listener? Is there agreement?
Oh, definitely not. This is where you see significant disagreement within those traditions for you.
Okay.
The main tension often centers on the idea of the sanctity of life, the belief that human life is inherently valuable, maybe given by God. Arguments against capital punishment often emphasize this, suggesting that only God has the right to take a life.
Makes sense.
However, arguments in favor sometimes point to specific passages in the Bible that seem to support capital punishment in certain situations, leading to a complex and ongoing debate within these faiths.
Which perfectly sets us up for you as we look at the specific arguments for and against capital punishment. Our source presents this as a kind of debate between Hugo Badao, a major critic, and Ernest Van den Hogg, a major supporter. Let's start with the issue of unequal application for our listener. Badao brings up the point about the statistical difference we talked about earlier.
The racial disparity.
Right, with people who kill white people being more likely to face execution. He concludes that this basic unfairness should lead us to get rid of the death penalty completely.
Badao's argument is really about fairness and equal justice for you. If the most severe punishment we have is clearly being applied unfairly based on race, it really damages the credibility of the entire justice system, doesn't it?
Yeah, it undermines it.
He basically argues that if a system can't apply the death penalty fairly, it shouldn't apply it at all.
And Van den Hogg's counter to this for our listener, how does he respond to this challenge of unequal application for you?
Well, Van den Hogg acknowledges that unequal application is a problem for you, but he doesn't think it means we should get rid of capital punishment altogether.
Okay, so what's his solution?
His view is that we should focus on fixing the system to make sure it is applied more fairly rather than abandoning the punishment itself. He might say, you know, the issue is with the discriminatory practices, not with the idea of capital punishment being a just response to certain very serious crimes. Justice demands it, even if we apply it imperfectly sometimes.
Fix the application, not abolish the punishment itself. Got it. Next up for you is the incredibly serious issue of miscarriages of justice, the risk of executing innocent people. Badao emphasizes how irreversible and tragic this is.
Absolutely.
And points to the many cases where people on death row have been found innocent and released. He even mentions an estimate, I think it was, around 4 innocent people being convicted of murder each year, some of whom could potentially end up facing execution.
This is perhaps the most emotionally powerful argument against capital punishment for you. The thought of the state taking the life of someone who is innocent is, well, it's a deeply wrong moral failure.
It's horrifying.
It is. Badao's point about the numerous exonerations, often after many years of appeals, really shows how prone to error the justice system can be and the devastating consequences when that error happens in a capital case.
Van den Hogg's response to this is quite stark for you, drawing parallels to other areas of life where accidental deaths occur, like transportation and construction.
Yeah. That analogy.
He seems to be suggesting that these risks, while tragic, don't necessarily mean we should stop those activities altogether. But isn't there a fundamental difference, though? In transportation, the goal isn't to intentionally take a life, whereas capital punishment is precisely that. Doesn't that difference in intent change the ethical calculus for you?
That's a really strong point, and Vandenhoog's argument is certainly provocative for you. He's essentially saying that life involves inherent risks, and the fact that innocent people might die as a result of the justice system, just like they might in other societal activities, doesn't necessarily mean we should dismantle the entire system. Mm-hmm. He even raises the question of whether we should stop imprisoning people altogether because innocent people are also wrongly incarcerated. It's an argument that leans towards weighing the potential loss of innocent life against what he sees as the benefits of capital punishment, primarily, for him, justice being served.
Justice again. Okay. Now, let's tackle the argument of deterrence for you. Bedell argues that there's no clear statistical proof that capital punishment is a better deterrent to violent crime than life imprisonment without the possibility of parole.
Right.
He stresses that the real comparison isn't between the death penalty and no punishment, but between the death penalty and a very severe alternative, like LWOP, life without parole.
Bedell's point is really important for you. Opponents of capital punishment often argue quite strongly that the possibility of spending the rest of one's life in prison is a strong enough deterrent.
You'd think so.
And that adding the threat of execution doesn't noticeably lower crime rates any further. The fact that there isn't clear, undeniable statistical evidence to the contrary really weakens the argument that capital punishment is necessary for deterrence.
Vandenhoog, however, appeals to what he calls basic human psychology for you, suggesting that a greater threat should intuitively lead to greater deterrence. You know, people fear death more than life in prison.
That's his intuitive argument, yeah.
But he also makes a really key point, circling back to what you said earlier. He argues that the main reason for capital punishment isn't actually deterrence, but rather justice retribution, the idea that the punishment should fit the crime.
Exactly. Vandenhoog believes that focusing too much on deterrence takes the attention away from what he sees as the central moral reason for capital punishment for you, that those who take a life deserve to forfeit their own. For him, achieving justice in this way is the primary goal, and while deterrence might be a positive side effect, it's not the fundamental justification.
So for Vandenhoog, even if it didn't deter anyone, it might still be justified on grounds of justice alone.
That seems to be his core position, yes. Justice demands it.
Okay. Finally, let's look at the financial cost for you. This one is maybe more practical. Bedell argues that the extensive legal processes and appeals involved in capital cases make it incredibly expensive.
Oh, yeah. Way more expensive.
Often much more expensive than keeping someone in prison for life. He suggests that switching to life without parole would save a lot of money while also eliminating the risk of executing an innocent person. He points out that people on death row often spend 10 or more years, sometimes decades, in appeals.
Bedell's argument here is a practical one for you, highlighting the significant financial burden that the lengthy legal procedures for capital punishment place on the criminal justice system. You've got complex trials, numerous appeals, specialized housing for inmates on death row. It all adds up.
Hugely.
His suggestion that life imprisonment without parole is a more cost-effective and equally severe alternative is a key argument for many who oppose the death penalty. Save money, save innocent lives.
And Vandenhoog's response, for our listener, does he dispute the cost?
Well, he points out that there are also significant long-term costs associated with housing and caring for someone serving a life sentence. You know, decades of food, health care, security.
True, that's not cheap either.
He suggests that when you consider decades of imprisonment, the costs of life imprisonment might be similar to, or maybe even greater than, the costs associated with the death penalty. He essentially argues for you that the financial argument isn't as clear-cut as Bedell makes it out to be, and that the long-term costs might even favor the death penalty in some cases. It's not a simple calculation.
Okay, we've covered a lot of ground on the philosophical and practical arguments for you. Now, let's turn to the biblical arguments for and against capital punishment, as outlined in our source. Let's start with the arguments in favor for our listener. The Old Testament passage from Genesis 9:6 is often cited. Whoever sheds human blood, by humans shall their blood be shed. For in the image of God has God made mankind. What's the reasoning here for you?
The reasoning here for you centers on the idea that because humans are created in God's image, human life has this unique, special value.
Sanctity of life.
Exactly. Therefore, taking a human life is seen as a profound offense against God and humanity that deserves the forfeiture of the offender's own life as a just consequence. It's viewed by supporters as upholding the sanctity of life by demanding a severe penalty for its violation.
But our source also points out a common response to this for you. The inconsistent application of Old Testament law. If we're going to take Genesis 9.6 so literally, why aren't we also applying the death penalty for other offenses that carried that punishment in the Old Testament? Things like certain sexual offenses or even disrespecting parents.
That's a key challenge to this argument for you, absolutely. Critics point out that selectively using Old Testament law without following all of it raises questions about, well, why we choose certain parts and ignore others.
Cherry picking.
Some would call it that. They also remind us that we don't live in a theocracy, a society governed directly by religious law in the same way that ancient Israel did. The context is different.
Okay. Another argument in favor for our listener comes from the New Testament, specifically Romans 13, where Paul talks about rulers not carrying the sword for no reason.
Right. Agents of wrath.
Acting as God's servants, agents of wrath, to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. The sword is interpreted by some as a tool of death, suggesting an approval of capital punishment.
The interpretation here for you is that Paul's mention of the sword represents the government's legitimate power to use deadly force when necessary to maintain justice and order. Supporters see this as the New Testament affirming the state's authority under God to execute criminals.
And the counterargument to this for our listener with the context there.
Well, the main counterargument for you is that the context of Romans 13 is really about the broader idea of obeying governing authorities in general.
Like paying taxes.
Exactly, including things like paying taxes. Paul is using the concept of the ruler's authority to maintain order, and his focus isn't specifically on capital crimes or whether the death penalty itself is morally right. Many argue that it's taking this passage out of its original context to apply it directly to the death penalty debate today.
Okay, so context matters. Now let's look at the biblical arguments against capital punishment for our listener. One key theme is the emphasis on mercy, right? Jesus saying in Matthew 5.7, "Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy." How is this applied to the death penalty debate for you?
Well, the emphasis on mercy in the teachings of Jesus, and really throughout the Bible, is often used as a reason to oppose capital punishment for you. The argument is pretty straightforward. If we, as individuals, are called to be merciful, then the state, acting on our behalf, should also reflect this value, even when dealing with the most terrible crimes. Mercy should temper justice.
The story of the adulterous woman in John 8 is also brought up for our listener, where Jesus famously refuses to condemn her, saying, "Let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone." What's the significance of this story in this context for you? It seems pretty direct.
It's a very powerful story, yeah. It highlights Jesus' compassion and his challenge to strict adherence to the law without considering mercy for you.
Right.
It's often seen as an example of prioritizing forgiveness and compassion over strict punishment. His refusal to endorse the stoning of the woman is viewed by many as a challenge to the death penalty in general. If Jesus wouldn't condemn her, should we?
However, our source also mentions a couple of responses or qualifications to this story for you.
Yes, it does. One point sometimes raised is that the legal requirements of the time weren't fully met specifically. The woman's male partner wasn't also brought before them for judgment as the law required.
A procedural point.
Another, perhaps more significantly for those who rely heavily on the exact words of the Bible, is that some scholars question whether this particular passage was originally part of the Gospel of John. It's not found in some of the oldest and most reliable manuscripts.
Oh, interesting. Textual criticism.
Exactly. So its authority is debated by some.
Finally, there's the argument against modern capital punishment based on Mosaic law's procedural requirements for you, such as the need for two or more eyewitnesses.
Right, who also had to participate.
Who also had to participate in the execution, maybe throwing the first stones. The point is that our current system doesn't follow these specific rules.
The argument here for you is that if we're going to look to Old Testament justice for guidance, we should also consider the safeguards it had in place. These were meant to ensure accuracy and prevent false accusations.
High burden of proof.
A very high burden. The fact that modern capital punishment often relies on different kinds of evidence, circumstantial evidence, forensic evidence, and doesn't involve eyewitness participation in the execution, raises questions about whether it's truly consistent with those ancient legal principles.
And the response to that argument for our listener, does it dismiss those procedures?
Well, the response often argues for you that these are really about the process, the procedures, and they don't change the underlying principle of just punishment, the concept of life for a life.
Okay.
The argument is that modern methods, like, say, DNA testing, can offer a similar or even greater level of certainty about someone's guilt as eyewitness testimony did back then. So they argue modern methods fulfill the spirit or the main purpose of those ancient procedural requirements, ensuring guilt, even if the methods themselves are different.
Wow, we've really taken a deep dive into a lot of complex material with you today, from the legal history, like Furman and Gregg, and how our understanding of cruel and unusual punishment has changed, to the basic theories behind why we punish deterrence, rehabilitation, retribution, and the many different ethical and theological viewpoints on capital punishment itself.
Absolutely. It's clear for you that there are no easy answers here. Mm-hmm. The legal situation is complicated. The ethical considerations are profound. And even within religious traditions, there's just a lot of debate.
Definitely no consensus.
Not at all. The arguments on both sides touch on really fundamental values like justice, fairness, the value of human life, and, you know, the role of the government in administering punishment.
So as we wrap up this deep dive with you, we're left with the ongoing complexities and the understanding that this is a conversation that continues to evolve in our society. It's not settled.
Indeed. And this leads to an important question for you, our listener, to maybe ponder. Thinking about all the arguments we've explored today, the legal precedents like McCluskey, the ethical principles like utilitarianism or Kantian thought, the theological interpretations from Genesis or Romans, what single aspect do you find most persuasive in shaping your own understanding of this issue? And perhaps even more importantly, why is that particular aspect so compelling to you? What fundamental beliefs or values might be influencing that perspective? It's definitely something to continue thinking about long after you're done listening.
A great final thought. Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive.